So the first days and months of parenthood for me and Jenny was Jenny and I was rather difficult. You know, some babies, they come home and they have like that cry that is like that. It's almost sweet. Like the baby cries and it's like, "Excuse me, I'm sorry. Will you pay attention to me?" type of cry. But no, we had the daughter who had the cry that was like, "You will pay attention to me or you will die," type of cry. The type of cry that like sets your nerves on ending, and the type of cry that it was like a shriek, you know, that shrill nails on a chalkboard cry. Some babies are easy. They coo and they sleep and they play. But my daughter, she had something else in store for us. So those first days and weeks, I have to admit, I was clueless. I had held a baby like twice in my life up to that point. I had changed one diaper, and when I changed the diaper, so this is before, this is somebody else's kid. We were babysitting one time. I changed the diaper, and I actually put it on backwards. I mean, that just shows I was clueless. And so my sweet wife got the lion's share of the work. I tried to jump in and help, but here she is confined into this dark room, trying to take care of this baby who's nonstop crying, who's every time you try and relax or sleep, she's there. Like she wouldn't let us sleep more than an hour or two for weeks. Every time we started to relax, like you sit down, you get ready to take that first bite of dinner, wah! You sit down, TV shows on, wah! You go to the bathroom. Like there was no escaping it. Like some of you have lived this. There was one point where there was a whole period, months on end, where every night from like 6 to 10 p.m., we called it the witching hour, she would just cry nonstop in this shrill cry. And the only way to get her to stop was literally to do a song and dance. So I would have to bounce her like this, and then we would sing to her the whole time for 4 hours without sleep. And there was one night where we were doing this, and we had already gone our 4 hours. We'd clocked in the time, and she was still crying. And so at this point, my very desperate wife looks at me and is like, "How long do we do this?" And I'm like, "I guess until we die." So there's one night in the middle of all that where we've put her down and we're like, "She's actually sleeping. Can you believe it?" And we're both wired, like, frazzled. We thought, okay, let's relax and find a nice movie. And we picked like the worst possible movie, a movie called Rendition, which this is 2008. So this is right after the Abu Ghraib prison scandal stuff. You guys know about this, right? The enhanced interrogation techniques used. Enhanced interrogation techniques for terrorist suspects. It was terrible. So this movie is basically a commentary on it. So we sit down and we watch this movie about torture. It's like, oh, what are we doing? So we're sitting there and we see this poor sap of a guy who gets, he's suspected of terror. So they put him into this confinement and then they don't let him sleep for more than an hour or two. And then every once in a while, they just blare this piercing music in his room and they force him to get up and do exercise. And we sit there and watch this movie and we feel awful about ourselves. And then we look at each other and we're like, wait a second. That's our life. We're struck by the fact that the exact same tactics that government agents would use to mentally break a terror suspect is what a new mom and dad have to go through. Like, it's the same stuff. If I told you, yes, I've confined my wife to a room, won't let her sleep, won't let her eat, won't let her go to the bathroom, piercing noise, you would think I was torturing her. And yet, as soon as I say, "It's a baby," well, that kind of torture, we celebrate that kind of torture, don't we? Over the past 7-8 years, this fact that our circumstances can be identical and yet tell a completely different story, that started to resonate with me. And I found a principle to be true. The first principle is this, is that parenting is actually a form of torture. But the second principle is this, and more importantly, the one I want to talk about today is this. It's not your circumstances that define your life. It's your story. Have you ever seen this before? So there's two people. One fails, gets rejected, goes through divorce, goes through bankruptcy, something terrible, and that becomes their story. And for the rest of their life, that's who they are. And then another person fails, gets rejected, goes through bankruptcy, goes through something terrible. But then somehow they manage to not make that their story. That's not their story, but they pick up and they manage to change and start a new story, a new life. They're their story. They're not defined by their circumstances. So you might live in this, suburban world, right? Where you have the dead-end job, the minivan with the crushed-in Cheerios in the backseat. You got the cookie-cutter 1970s house. I know it because I own it. You have the kids always complain, they have better stuff than me. Shut up. I know they do. You have the dead-end job. You have all those things. And so some people live in that life, and that is their life. That's their story. But then someone just down the street lives in the exact same world, has the exact same dead-end job, the exact same minivan, the exact same house, the exact same everything, and yet their story is vastly different, that they find a way to manage to rise above it and live a life that blesses everyone around them. Same circumstances, different story. So one person will suffer from abuse as a child, and that will so mark them that for the rest of their life, that's their story. They're a victim. And then you meet my mom, who suffered child abuse as a child, but I don't even know the details of it because that's not her story. You know what her story is? Her story is that she met Jesus Christ, she got married, built a healthy marriage, a good marriage, raised two boys who are both in full-time ministry, and then spent decades of her life focusing on God's global mission and pouring into other women. That's her story. Same circumstances, different story. Today we're going to hear a story from a man named Matthew. And do you know what his story is? Do you know what his job is? Matthew was a tax collector. That meant he made a profession of stealing money, of taking money from his brothers, Jewish brothers and sisters, and paying it to their Roman oppressors so that the Romans, the soldiers, could rape, pillage, plunder, oppress, continue to oppress his own people. That his story was that he was hated. He was a traitor. He was a crook. But that story changed. It's not his story because Matthew met a man named Jesus who came up and said, "Follow me." And Matthew, the tax collector, became Matthew the disciple. And Jesus not only changed his story, but in this story, he changed the course of human history using a man named Matthew. Today, we're going to look at this. This Gospel of Matthew is the story that not only changed his life, but changed the course of history. May I suggest that if it's a story we accept and believe, that it will change our lives as well. Our text for today is Matthew chapter 1, Matthew chapter 1, starting in 1 through 7. And the opening lines of this life-changing story, the greatest story ever told, the story that's going to make sense of your life and our world, the story to end all stories, the opening lines of this fantastic story is this. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and blah, blah, blah. A genealogy, really? So if you're going to tell the most interesting, most powerful story anyone's ever heard, how do you begin with a genealogy? Okay, so this is not the blockbuster car chase scene we're used to at the opening scene of a story, right? So we need to, today, there's all these levels that might be lost because we're going to go 2,000 years and half a world away to try and understand why Matthew would tell this story this way. So I want you to just imagine with me. Imagine what it would be like to live in the first century. You know, there's no lights, there's no telephones, there's no Twitter, there's no America. Imagine that you're living in this time under Roman oppression. Caesar is Lord way over there in Rome, and he's got soldiers all over this vast empire. And here you are, someone shows up and gives you a copy of this book. this rare copy, and you take this copy and you sneak it home. You make sure no one's looking. You lock the door. You go in and you open this book. And the very first words of this dangerous, dangerous book that you're reading are this: the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Christ. Do you know what that word means? Do you know what that is? It's not Jesus' last name. It's not just a word that you say when someone cuts you off in traffic. That is a title. It's a title that if you use that title in the first century, you ended up getting hunted down and killed in the first century. It's the title that means anointed king. To call anyone other than Caesar king was a death sentence. That from the very first line of this book, you realize that Matthew so believes this story that he's willing to risk his own life to put it on paper. He's calling someone other than Caesar king. But it's not just Jesus Christ. It's Jesus Christ, the son of David. That he says this king is a son of David, that he has the legitimate birthright to the Davidic kingship. So we just did this last week, if you were here. Samuel chapter 7, that God made a promise to David that one of his kids, one of his sons, his descendants would sit on the throne forever and ever and ever. 1,000 years later, Matthew says, it's coming true. This is the son of David. But it's not just that promise. It's for 700 years since the time of the prophets, like Isaiah, Jeremiah. This is the son of David that everyone talked about. Psalm chapter 2, the son of David who would be the son of God. Isaiah 7, the son of David who would be born of a virgin. Isaiah 9, the son of David who would be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Jeremiah 23, the son of David who would reign wisely, do what is just, etc., etc. That Matthew says, this Jesus is king. He's the son of David and he's the son of Abraham. He is the very son that God promised to Abraham 2,000 years before this moment. Genesis chapter 22, one of your sons will come and through him the entire world will be blessed. So in this first line, Matthew's, he's not saying Jesus is born and here's his genealogy. Jesus is not another person in history. According to Matthew, this is not another story among the billions of stories. That this is the story. This is the thing that you've been waiting for, even if you didn't know it. This is the thing that you've been longing for your whole life. This is the thing that every one of you and every one of us and everyone in history has been looking for. Though they couldn't necessarily put it into words. He's here. It's beautiful. It's triumphant. And then Matthew proceeds to bore us for the next 15 verses. Watch this. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab. Great name, by the way. And Amminadab the father of Nashon, and blah, 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 blah. What's Matthew doing here? Does Matthew really care that we know the great-great-great-grandfather of Jesus? That's my question. What does Matthew want us to see? If Matthew is literally willing to risk his life to write this story, is he willing to risk his life so that you know the great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of Jesus? Is that what's so important here? Or is there something going on here? What if I were to tell you that buried in all this list of historical boringness, there's actually a story unfolding that will explain the circumstances not only of all of history, but your own life. That there's a story here, an overarching story here that he wants to tell that will explain, make sense of not only the newspaper, but your personal past. If I told you that, would you believe it? I probably wouldn't either. But maybe if God gives us eyes to see, we can see something here. I'm going to show you three things out of this long list of boring names that I think Matthew wants us to see, and there are three things that really pop out of the text as problems, as though Matthew made some type of big mistake when he wrote this text, and I think he did this intentionally so that we would see a story develop. I need you to hang on with me here. This is going to be three things that are really key to explaining the story that Matthew wants to see, not only of all of human history, but our own lives, all right? If you got your handouts today, we're going to go through the three points. And the first one is this. Matthew starts the genealogy with Jesus. Now, that might seem absolutely obvious to us. Matthew starts the genealogy with Jesus. We see that in the first line, right? The book of the genealogy of Jesus. And if you've ever, if you've read your Old Testament, or let's go back to the first century. If you're a good Jew, all right? You attend synagogue, you show up at least on the holidays. Thank you for coming, by the way. Show up on the holidays. You show up to synagogue when it's important. And what do? You sit down, you read the Torah, the Old Testament. And what do you read? You read, okay, let me go through some of this. Genesis chapter 5. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Ah. Genesis chapter 6. This is the book of the genealogy of Noah. Genesis chapter 10. This is the book of the genealogy of Shem. Genesis chapter 11, this is the book of the genealogy of Terah. Genesis chapter 25, Genesis chapter 37, and that's just the book of Genesis. Do you get the point? You've read this before. If you're a good Jew who occasionally goes to synagogue, you've heard this a lot. This is really, really, really familiar with you. So in order to understand what Matthew's saying here, you need to understand that there's a basic pattern to how you explain a genealogy to Old Testament Hebrew Jews, right? And it can be explained quite simply with Russian dolls. All right? Russian dolls. You know the kind? So these are the kind that have the little inlay thing. So when you ask an Old Testament Jew, how are babies made? And they don't know anything about genetics or genes or all the biology of that. They think in terms of, well, there was a man named Abraham, and inside of him, there's a man named Isaac, and inside of him, there's another man named Jacob, and then he had one named, et cetera, Judah, and then Judah had et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this list. When you think through an Old Testament genealogy, you should think through Russian dolls. So let me give you an example of this. This is how genealogies work, that everyone was in the father of the genealogy. They're all inside, and they come out one by one by one as history reveals. So this is the genealogy, chapter 5 of Genesis, the book of the genealogy of Adam. It goes like this, Adam, and then inside of Adam was Seth, and inside of Seth was Enosh, and inside of Enosh was Kenan, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So if you go down through history, this is why the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 5 and in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 will say, all of you, everyone is born in Adam. What does that mean? It means Adam's the big one, and you are inside of him. Then when Adam sinned. Everyone died in Adam. We're in him. That's exactly what they picture. Right? So the Greek word for genealogy is the same word Genesis. If you want to understand a genealogy, it's where you come from. It's your personal Genesis. It's your beginnings. And every single one of these genealogies, so here's the one of Shem, Genesis 11. Here's the one of Terah. Here's the one of Isaac. Every one of these genealogies follows the exact same pattern. From the founder, you're inside the founder, then it goes to the next person. So you're always, the genealogy is in the founder. They're the Genesis, the beginning of the genealogy. You get the point? Yeah. So every single one in the Old Testament begins with the most ancient person and goes to the son. Then we come to this. The book of the genealogy of Jesus. Now, what do you notice here? What's wrong with that? If you're an Old Testament Jew who's been reading genealogies your whole stinking life, like every time you go to the world, no, another genealogy is going to be read. What do you notice? You notice immediately something that is called the book of the genealogy, the Genesis of Jesus. But Jesus' genealogy starts with Abraham. This is all wrong, Matthew. You got it wrong. Matthew, don't you see? This is the book of the genealogy of Abraham, and then Jesus comes out way at the end. Matthew, you've got this all wrong. You can't possibly mean that, right? Like, to call this the genealogy of Jesus would demean something crazy, like Jesus somehow influenced Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Judah. Like, that doesn't work, right? What? Quick question, not a trick one. What role did you play in your parents having you? None is the answer. None. And you know how I know that? Because you did not exist yet. You see, in order for this to work, Matthew, that would have to mean that Jesus existed before he was born. You see, for this to work, this would mean that Jesus individually formed and chose. He was the genesis of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. For this to work, it would mean that Jesus is actually the author of human history. And perhaps most unsettling, it would mean that he picked the people in his family line, which brings us to the second problem of this. So the first problem is that Jesus, the genealogy starts with Jesus, and it shouldn't have unless it means all of these things. The second one is this. Matthew includes people that shouldn't be included in a genealogy. Look at this list. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab, blah, 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 and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. Let me point these names out here real quick. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, the wife of Uriah. As a general rule of thumb, you don't include women in your genealogy. It's just not a thing you do. Not necessary for the Jews, you don't do it. And if for some good reason you did include a woman in your genealogy, you don't include these types of women. So do you know who these women are? You know Tamar? That's right. She's a from that people group, the murderous, God-hating, filthy, disgusting, try-and-kill-everybody group known as the Canaanites. And what's her story? She dressed up like a prostitute and seduced her father-in-law. What about Rahab? Well, she's the famous prostitute from the land of Jericho. What about Ruth? Ruth, you're like, okay, finally, Ruth, someone who's safe. But Ruth, you know who she is? She's a saucy Moabitess. Read the story. What does she do? She waits until this rich Jew is basically passed out drunk, and she comes in to find him asleep, passed out there, and she uncovers his feet, which is a euphemism for, I'm not going to say it. And then the wife of Uriah. Don't ask. Matthew includes people in this genealogy that you do not include in your genealogy. If you want to show that you are king, if you want to show who you are, you hide these people. You do what everyone else does. You pretend like they don't exist. But this is compounded by the fact that if the first point is true, if Jesus was actually, this is his genealogy, he's the genesis of everything that comes out of it. If he's the one, then this means that Jesus not only allowed, these aren't just historical mishaps, that Jesus actually picked the people in his genealogy. If Jesus is the author of history, he could have picked anyone he wanted. He could have picked really smart, good-looking, upwardly mobile people. He could have picked people who like recycle and like return their carts to the cart corral giant. He could have picked those people, perfect people, the people that you really want to hate. But you can't because they're perfect, dang on it. He could have picked anyone he wanted, but he didn't. He picked Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and the wife of Uriah. And that's not just the story, though. He didn't just pick them. So he picks Tamar. And it's true. She's a Canaanite. She's a godless woman from this godless people. He picks her and then he changes her story. Because at the end of the story, if you read Genesis chapter 38, she doesn't end as a godless prostitute. But Judah, the great son of Jacob, looks at her and says, truly, you are more righteous than I, that she reveals the righteousness of God to God's people. Rahab, Rahab, the famous harlot. What did she do? Is that her story? That she's, it's true. She was a prostitute in Jericho, but that's not her story. Jesus picks her up, says, you're part of my people. And he saves her out to show his grace. Ruth, what is she? She is not just the example of a saucy Moabitess, though she is. She's the example that will show God's people what true faithfulness looks like. The wife of Uriah. The wife of Uriah is perhaps, and we'll get to this in a few months, it is perhaps the most offensive, terrible, worst moral tragedy in all of scriptures that God then picks up and uses to create the best, most holy, most wholesome time in the history of God's people, that through her would come Solomon, the great peace of the kingdom, the greatness of the kingdom of Israel. If you're here today and you're like, I'm not a very spiritual person, if you got a past, if you've done some things that shouldn't be mentioned in church, can I just say you're in good company? Jesus picks you. That you're the one he wants in his family. You're the one he delights in. You're the one he wants to use for his kingdom purposes. So the first point is that Matthew starts the genealogy with Jesus, that Jesus is somehow the author of all human history, that this whole story, this whole life, this whole world we're living, everything, somehow he's orchestrating it, even the sinful parts, to create his own story, his own genealogy that's all about him. The second point is that he includes people that you wouldn't necessarily include, that he includes broken, sinful, messed up people. And then the third point is this. Matthew's numbers don't all add up. So if you read through, you'll notice that Matthew does something interesting here. In these 17 verses, he breaks up the genealogy of Jesus, thankfully, into three sections. The first section is verses 2 through 6. It says it goes from Abraham to David. The second section is verses 6 through 11. It goes from David to the Babylonian exile. And then verses 12 through 16 go from the Babylonian exile to the birth of Jesus. So you have these three major sections leading up to the time of Jesus. And then Matthew helpfully points out this in verse 17. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations. And from David to the deportation of Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation of Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. And all of this sounds really, really great until you start counting. How many of you have counted the genealogy of Jesus before? Yes, well, let's do it right now. Yes, there's only 13 in the first set. And the third set, there's only 13 too. We say, well, maybe there's something artful going on here. Maybe you double up the uses on the middle set, so this somehow makes sense. Maybe that's how he gets 14 out of it. But here's the problem. If you start fact-checking it, you go to the second set of names in this list, from the time of David to the Babylonian exile. This is the list Matthew gives us, which does, thankfully, add up to 14. But then you go back to 1 Chronicles. You check out every single name. And the good thing is, man, these are historical people. There goes my Russian doll. But here's the thing, if you check it out, you'll find this. There's at least 17 generations recorded from the time of David to the Babylonian exile. See, one, Matthew's math, it doesn't add up. It doesn't add up to 14, 14, 14. He just said it did, but it doesn't. And then even if it does, we can look at the list and we can say, no, Matthew, you got it wrong. You're missing at least three generations in there. What are you doing? What's going on here? Was Matthew really so bad at math that he couldn't add to 14? Does Matthew really think that we'll never count this? So, here's my question. Is Matthew really this bad at math, or is he doing something that we do not understand? Could it be that we just don't get it? So, yesterday, I was on Facebook, and a friend of mine, he posted something that I thought was rather humorous. It was a misunderstanding. He He says this. He says, I got my gun permit yesterday. And I'm like, oh no, is this another post on guns? Like, I can't even stand it. But so I kept on reading. He says, I got my gun permit yesterday, then went over to the local gun shop to get a small 9mm for home protection. Then he said, when I was ready to pay by credit card for the gun and bullets, the cashier said, now strip down facing me. Making a mental note to complain to the NRA about the gun control wackos running amok, I did as she instructed, so strips down facing her. When the hysterical shrieking and alarm subsided, I found out that she was actually referring to how I should place my credit card in the reader. Strip down facing me. Yes, I have some interesting friends. So here's my point. If in today's world, people who speak the same language, we're from the same generation, we're from the same culture, can come in and one person be talking about a credit card and the other one taking off his clothes, do you think it's possible that when we talk to Matthew, 2,000 years, who probably spoke Aramaic, wrote in Hebrew and Greek, do you think it's possible we might be misunderstanding him here and that he's not as stupid as we might think? Just saying. So here's what we're going to do here. And this is going to be a place that gets really uncomfortable for some of us. We have to reckon with the fact that Matthew doesn't care about our modern historical standards. He doesn't. He's not trying to give us every single name in the genealogy. He's just as bored with genealogies as you and I are. We have to reckon with the fact that he does not consider history a series of events to be analyzed objectively. He doesn't. In fact, I would argue, and you'll see this throughout his book, he says that if you don't understand the interpretation of the events themselves are meaningless. That if you don't understand how to interpret the circumstances, if you don't have the story, the circumstances are meaningless, pointless. That if you're confined and have loud, piercing noises, it could be a story about torture, or it could be a story about being a new parent. He says, when you come to history, when you come to your own life, do you think it's just suffering and one thing after the next? Or is there actually a story going on here? Is there something bigger in all of this mess of names and brokenness and hurt that we see in our news and in our lives all around us? And Matthew says, yes. And if you want to know what the answer is, 14, 14, 14. So with that, I'm going to close. Have you guys ever read the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Do you know the story? There's this, the hero of the story, he travels across space and time, the entire length of the universe, comes to this supercomputer called Deep Thought, and he comes to get the answer to the question, the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything. And when he gets there, finally at the end of the story, the answer is 42. It's like, 42, what does that mean? That's the point. The answer is something that you can't comprehend. Now, is this what Matthew's doing? Matthew, what's the meaning of life? You said that there's something worth dying for here. You're willing to risk your life to tell us what's the answer to all the meaning of life, the universe, all the suffering in my life. 14, 14, 14. So we're going to have to do a little homework here. Your Hebrew alphabet. As you all know, I'm sure, they didn't use the Arabic numeral system in the ancient world, right? You all knew this, of course. Instead, I'm sure you're all extremely excited about this. So this is the first few letters of the Hebrew alphabet. This is Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, He, Vav. And so when you want to write your numbers, you don't have a numeral system. So what do? You assign values to each one of these. Think Roman numerals, right? This is what we do. This is what they did in the ancient world. So you take each one of these letters, and Aleph equals 1, Beit equals 2, Gimel, Dalet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So when you write the name David, it is There's no vowels used in the original Hebrew. It is the letters, so we would write DVD. And notice they write it this way, DVD. So if you take those numbers, believe it or not, and you assign the numerical values to it, it's 4 plus 6 plus 4, which equals 14. Now, if you think this is absolute insanity, it does seem a little insane to me, doesn't it? Now, but you'll notice that this is actually something that was done in the ancient world. Assigning numerical values to names was something that they did. Read the book of Revelation. What's the number of the name of the Antichrist? Yeah, you've heard of it. So they do this type of thing. So what does Matthew read when he reads across all of human history, all the names, all the brokenness, all the events? He doesn't read just a list of names. It's not that long, boring list of names. What does he see? All of human history crying out again and again and again. There's a son of David. There's a son of David. There's a son of David. He's coming. He's coming. He's coming. And now he's here. But notice, he doesn't just write 14. He writes 14, 14, 14. So the other thing that you should know, book of Leviticus chapter 23, it gives you the calendar, right? Calendar of how the calendar system, how all of human history and how your year, how your week, how your moment by moment is to be marked out, sacred time for God. How is time made holy and sacred? And it's built upon a series of sevens. How many days are there in a week? Yeah, and what day is the holy day? The seventh, the Sabbath. And then during the year, there are how many major festivals? Can you guess? Yeah, and the seventh festival of the year is the biggest festival. It's the big giant party. Every 7 years is the sabbatical year, a year of rest. And then you come to every seventh. Every 49th year. Do you know what that is? It's the year of Jubilee. In the year of Jubilee, in the seventh seven, it's a year without work, without stress, without schedules. It's a year in which literally all your debts are forgiven. Imagine your home debt, your car debt, your credit card debt. All debts are forgiven and all slaves are set free. Everyone's to go back to their original parcel of land that God gave them. So I want you to picture this. On the 7-7th, every 7-7s, you're supposed to have a year in which there's no rich and no poor. There's no master and there's no slave. There's no employee and no employer. There's no, for a year. Everyone, you know what your identity is for a year? You don't achieve anything. You're a child of God. That's all you are. There's nothing to achieve, there's nothing to earn, there's nothing to lose, and it's just a gift. It's not because you saved up your money and you get the retirement. No, it's a gift from God. All your debts, all your sin, everything's forgiven because for a year, you're set free from slavery to materialism, from achievements, from making yourself better than others. And so when Matthew reads human history, it's not just 14, David. It's 14, 14, 14. That is a series of six sevens. Do you know what he's saying? Jesus is born. And it's the seventh seven. That all of human history has been waiting for this moment. When we will celebrate a rest that can't be earned. The seventh seven is coming and his name is Jesus. He will give you a rest from trying to earn your value in life. He's going to give you a rest from comparing yourself to others. He's going to give you a rest from proving yourself to your parents, to your boss, to your spouse, to your kids. He's going to forgive the debts that you can't pay back. And there's no charge to it. He forgives them. They're written. It's all has been paid. He's going to set you free from slavery to stuff, slavery to achievement, slavery to food, slavery to entertainment, slavery to what other people think of you. And then he's going to invite you to let go of all of that and just be a child of God. Because he picks you. broken, imperfect, messed up. He picks you. He can pick anyone. But he picks you to be part of his family, to enter into his rest, to forgive your debts. And that is the hope. And that's the story, or the beginning of the story of Christmas. But for the rest, you'll have to come back next week.